Cody. Morning, everybody. How you doing?
Morning.
You guys good?
Yeah.
All right. Well, glad you guys are here this morning. Why don't I give you about 10 seconds just to ask the Lord to speak to you today? Lord, thanks for hearing our prayer, and thank you that you hear every prayer individually, and then you respond individually to each one of us. And so we trust that you will give each of us exactly what we need for where we are in this morning. And in your name we pray, amen. All right, in a group this size, there's always a pretty significant number, if not all of us, that are at a place in our lives where we need some kind of miracle, some kind of thing. We need God to do some big thing in our life. And it may be that you're in a place where some hopes you've had through the years are all becoming hopeless, or some dream is turning into a nightmare, or it may be that you got your back up against the wall financially and you're thinking there's just no way this is going to work. Maybe you have just gone too far finally and you violated some trust of some sort and you're thinking, man, this will never get fixed. It's just almost beyond, you know, resurrection. Or maybe there's some relational thing. Anyway, there's all kinds of things. There's a million reasons why we could be sitting here and be in need of a miracle. And usually what happens is when that happens, we're kind of overwhelmed. We got this big thing. We begin to try to run faster. We try to work harder. We try to dig a little deeper to figure out some way to overcome whatever this thing is that we're facing. But there's another way. There's another way. The Bible goes to great lengths to tell us about a God who loves us and loves to do miracles in our lives. A God that is at work in us and around us all the time. And so this morning, what we're going to do is launch a 3-week study taking a look at this God who loves to do miracles and talk about how to live when I need a miracle. So we're going to look at it over the next 3 or 4 weeks. And 3 weeks. And I want you to pay close attention to the title, because I chose this on purpose. When I Need a Miracle. The name of this series is not How to Get a Miracle. Okay? Yeah, I want you to be clear on that. Because I'm not going to give you, it's going to be a 3-part deal, but this is not like 3 steps to a guaranteed miracle. This is not like plug in these 3 quarters and then you get what you want. I cannot give you a formula that will force God's hand and make him give you what it is that you want and or need. That is superstition. Okay? That is an attempt to control God. And we cannot do that. God is God. This is when I need a miracle. What do I do? What are my parts in this thing? What is my role in this thing? And so, you know, I'm going to give you some thoughts on how you live when you need a miracle. And then it's up to God to do whatever God chooses to do. We will learn how to walk more and more by faith, and then we will see what God does on the backside of this deal. Now, as we launch into this thing this morning, there's a foundational question we've got to ask. And it's a simple question: is, are miracles even possible? Over the last several hundred years, more and more, it's become increasingly, there's an increasing skepticism that miracles are even possible. And how do you justify, reconcile science and miracles in our world? And I mean, a couple hundred years ago, David Hume argued that because of the uniformity of the natural law, that there was no room for the supernatural in our world. And that miracles become impossible because they are a violation of the natural law. And over the last several hundred years, there's been voice after voice after voice that has come along saying that miracles are not a reality. And some of that comes from the voices that say, and look, this is going to be 5 minutes. I'm not going to answer every question we may have in this regard. Just a couple of simple, broad thoughts. But sometimes the thought is, because of the scientific method that is a repeatable thing, that since we can't repeat it and study it, then there's this whole idea that it's not a reality. But that doesn't really work, because the scientific method is for something that can be measured, that can be controlled, and a miracle by nature is outside of that. It is a one-off event where God intervenes and it begins to, it's not going to be something that can be controlled in a lab. So if you're only going to believe what is controlled in a lab, you're going to struggle with history, God, all kinds of other things. But tied up in this whole idea of no miracles, underneath that, because of this con- conviction of the natural law, there is also that the sub-premise under that is that there, if there are no miracles, there can be no God, or if there is no God, there can be no miracles. So God kind of gets worked out of this deal, and it's the idea that there are natural laws, and God is outside of that, therefore God doesn't exist. And so that, you know, miracles become an inconsistency with a natural law. Therefore, God is not there and miracles don't happen. But if this were like a sheer cliff, then I were to come up here, and it was a real tall cliff, not like 2 feet, a real tall cliff, and I were to come take a flying leap off, the law of gravity is going to control what happens to me next. And it's not going to end well, right? And so if I go launching myself off, the law of gravity kicks in. However, if I jump off that exact same cliff with a hang glider and I actually know what I'm doing and it works, right, then the law of aerodynamics supersedes the law of gravity. You with me on that? And so what we discover is that if there is indeed a God and he is supernatural or supranatural and outside of the natural, that there are times when the God who actually created the natural can supersede that, and the law of God overcomes the law of nature in those moments. And so what we have to be careful of, and some of the dangers of what has become more than the scientific method and has become scientism, is that science, that is very good, and I'm not at all bashing science, our scientists, what scientists are doing is phenomenal. But when science moves from its ability to study what's going on around us and apply it to lives, and they move into philosophy, science now becomes a religion. And because there is no way to prove categorically that there is a God or there is not a God. We can study it, we can bring evidence, but we cannot prove it. So when science attempts to prove or say categorically there is no God, it has moved from science to philosophy or theology and has now become a step of faith. And so, you know, so biblically, as for us as Christians, a big part of the Christian faith is miracles. And so what I'm going to suggest this morning is, if you're here and you're skeptical, I'm so glad you're here. I really am. And I'm not necessarily going to try to argue you into this. But what I would ask is, over the next couple of 3 weeks, that you would at least just have an open mind. What if? What if there were a God? What would he do? What if there were miracles? What would they look like? What if the Bible was legitimate? What, you know? And so I would encourage you just to sort of take a what-if attitude, kind of have an open mind, and then let's just take a look at what the Bible says about how miracles work and our roles in that, the whole thing, okay? So, having said that, I want to introduce you to a guy who is in desperate need of a miracle. Grab your Bible, turn over, if you would, to Mark chapter 5, and I want to introduce you to a guy named Jairus. And Jairus was at this place where he was, like many of you, at a place where it was hopeless, and he needed God to do something, or it was not going to go well. So in the Gospel of Mark, about 3/4 of the way through the Bible, you'll find Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mark chapter 5, we're going to start at verse 21. And it tells the story, and it's a series. What's going on actually is a series of miracles where Jesus has been on one side of the lake, gone to the other side, and then come back from that side of the lake to the original side, and that's where we pick up the story. Verse 21, when Jesus had again crossed over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there, and seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet, and he pleaded earnestly with him. My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live. So Jesus went with him. I'm going to make the assumption that it was somewhat difficult for Jairus to make this move for a lot of different reasons. Jairus is a leader, a ruler in the synagogue. Now, the synagogue, if you're not familiar, is essentially, if I'm going to parallel it, it's the local church for the Jewish religion. The temple is the centerpiece. It's in Jerusalem. But in every village of size, there was a synagogue. It was a local expression of the Jewish faith. And there would be rulers within that, leaders of that. And then all of the Jews would come there and worship every Saturday on the Sabbath. And then for the big things, they'd make the trek to Jerusalem. And so this is the local expression of faith. It's the local church, if you will, in that community. And what has happened over the years that have come along is that Jesus is increasingly unwelcome in the synagogue. He has over and over and over offended the leaders of the Jewish faith and the leaders of the synagogues. And he's gone into these synagogues on a Sabbath, on a day when he's not supposed to heal people, and it kind of irritates folks. And he just keeps going into that and healing people on these Sabbath days. And people are a little irritated. So Jesus is increasingly becoming public enemy number one. Now, we have no idea what Jairus really thought about Jesus. We don't know if he was open to Jesus, followed Jesus, or hated Jesus. But what we know is that all of his peers, many of his peers, are irritated, mad, trying to kill and attack Jesus. So for Jairus, to, as a synagogue leader, to go against the flow, to go against the current and go to Jesus would have been a big deal. And on top of that, he's a leader, which makes him maybe like an elder or a trustee, you know, a board member of some sort. He had it together or he wouldn't have been in that role. More than likely, he was more wealthy than the average bear. He was probably well-known in the community. He was important. He was influential. He was a man of dignity. And if there's one thing we know, is that the more powerful you get, the more influential you get, the more difficult it is to show weakness. People who are powerful have to appear to have it together. And to show weakness, to run and fall at the feet of Jesus is a huge undignified thing. But his position, all this power, didn't help him. His little baby is dying, and he would have had to battle pride, prejudice, all kinds of stuff, and then go to Jesus. So I love what Max Lucado says on your outline when he says, a man reaches a point where his desperation is a notch above his dignity. And that's where we find Jairus. His little girl, the sunshine of his life, his little princess is dying. And my assumption, he's done everything he can, that he's called every doctor available, that he's offered every sacrifice imaginable, that he's done all that he can. And if you've ever stood like I have, at the bed of a child who is dying and seen the agony in the parents, then you know where Jairus was. You realize his desperation. And even then, I'm amazed that in what appeared to be his daughter's final days, her final moments perhaps, he has wrestled himself away from her deathbed to go, we don't know how far. We don't know if it was an village to village. We don't know if it was across the region, but he has left his daughter on what might be a fool's errand to go find a healer and say, do something for my child. And that's Jairus, who throws himself in desperation at the feet of this country preacher and says, do something. And you can feel the emotion, can't you, when you read those words in verse 23, that he fell at his feet and he begged him, please come and put your hands on my daughter. And it all kind of jams up in his throat and he gets it out. And then Jesus, and I love the way it ends. It says the phrasing is just so great in the way it's written in verse 24, where it says, so Jesus went with him. And the way it's phrased, Jairus is like, Jairus is grabbing him and dragging him along, saying, come on, we're going to go, and Jesus is going with him. That's just such a tender statement. But along the way, there's an interruption. We won't say much about it. It's another great story of healing. But let me just read it, because pick it up at the end of verse 24. It says, a large crowd followed and pressed around him, and there was a woman there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years, which, by the way, Jairus' daughter is 12 years old. So we have these two daughters of God who have both been, you know, both 12 years old. And so in verse 25 or 26 it says, and she had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. And when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak, because she thought, if I just touch his clothes, I will be healed. And that's what happens. Immediately her bleeding stopped, and she felt in her body that she was freed from the suffering. And at once, Jesus realized that power had gone out from him, and he stops. He turns around in the crowd and says, who touched me? Come on, who was it? I felt it. Who touched me? And the disciples are great. Look at what they said. He said, you see all these people crowding around touching you? We all touched you. And you turn around and said, who touched me? But Jesus kept looking around to see who had done it. And then the woman, knowing what had happened to her, came up and fell at Jesus' feet and trembling with fear and told him the whole truth. And he said to her, daughter, my daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Now, and then we return back to Jairus and his daughter. But can't you just imagine the scene, right? If you're Jairus, you've gone up, you've thrown yourself at Jesus' feet. He says, sure, let's go. And you're trying not to be rude. You're trying not to drag Jesus, but you're trying to grab hold and move him as quickly as you can. You're trying to walk as quickly as you can to get Jesus to keep pace. You're trying to get him there in time. And then after a few steps, a little while, everything stops, and you're shifting back and forth, and you're trying desperately to be polite because you don't want to be rude to Jesus because you need Jesus desperately, you know, and you're checking your little Apple sundial, and you're trying to find, let's go, we got to go, we got to go, we got to go, right? I mean, it's all of this stuff. You're trying to race along and race along and race along until finally, and you're kind of going, who cares? She's this old woman. She is unclean. She is poor. It doesn't matter. It's my daughter. Until finally, it's over. Verse 35. But Jesus, while Jesus was still speaking, some men came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, and says, your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? It's over. It's finished. There's finality. She's gone. Look at verse 36. Ignoring what they said, Jesus told the synagogue ruler, don't be afraid, just believe. If you have an underliner or a highlighter, those words should be underlined. Don't be afraid, just believe. Don't be anxious, don't be worried, don't despair, just trust me. Just trust me. And it's fascinating, isn't it? Because Jesus gives no promise here. The guy's come up, your daughter is dead, and Jairus is coming unglued, he's unhinged, it's over. And Jesus stops and says, don't be afraid, just trust me. He doesn't say, hey, don't worry, I'm going to raise her from the dead. He doesn't say, don't worry, it's all going to work out great. Don't worry. All he says is, trust me. Jesus, I mean, the scriptures make these grandiose promises. I have a plan for your life. I will never leave you or forsake you. I'm taking you somewhere. But it's never specific. Jesus simply says, trust that I love you. Trust that I am able. Trust me with exactly where you are. And he doesn't give any promise about what's going to happen. He says, don't be afraid, just trust me. And then the story kind of takes off. Verse 37 says he didn't let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And he says he did not let anyone, in verse 38, when they came to the home of the synagogue ruler, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. And he went in and said to them, I love this. Jesus got such a great sense of humor. He walks in and he goes, hey, what's all the hubbub? You know, what's all the commotion? What's all the wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep. And they laughed at him, it says. And after he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and it went in with where the child was, and he took her by the hand, and he said to her, Talitha kum, which means, little girl, I say to you, get up. And immediately the girl stood up and walked around, and she was 12 years old. At this, they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to let anyone know about this, and he told them to give her something. That kind of makes sense. At the end, she hadn't eaten. We don't know how long she's been dead. We don't know how long she's been ill, but surely she's hungry, she's healthy, she's ready to go. And Jesus says, look, go make her a sandwich. Get her some PB&J in here. We got to get her strength up, right? And this is great. And then he says this weird thing. Look, hey, let's not talk about this. Let's not tell anybody. Let's just keep it. It's all right here. Mom and dad, three disciples, me, the little girl. That's it. We're not, I'm still the most word. Which is kind of not going to work anyway. Because he's got all the servants who've already come out and told everybody that she's dead. They've got the mourners in there. You may not understand ancient Near Eastern funeral habits, but the way that would work, if you had influence and money, you would hire mourners to come to your house. And these were people who were really good at crying. Okay, these were like the ones who could just sob and, well, you carry it out. You know, these were really good mourners. And so because he's an influential guy, he's got the cream of the crop in his house. And so and he walks in going, hey, she's not dead. And they're going, dude, we do this all the time. We're like on the A-list. You know, it's like, you know that bands that play out all the weddings? They do all their wedding receptions. And everybody goes, oh, you want to get that band? They're the best. He has the band. He's got the best guys in there crying. And they can do it in harmony, you know, and whatever. And so they're going, look, we see dead all the time. This girl was dead. She is dead. And Jesus said, let's not make a big stink out of this. Let's not talk about it. So what do we do with this? When you need a miracle, when you're like Jairus, what do you do with this? Let me give you some thoughts. And the first thing is this, is that we had to look up instead of where we usually look. Because where we usually look at the obstacles, don't we? So you got to look up instead of staring at the obstacles. See, if you're at the point where you need a miracle, this is something huge. This is something gargantuan. It's not that you don't have enough sugar to make the cookies. This is something that is life-altering, life-changing. It is massive. And if there's one thing we know, when we're up against something huge, something massive, it magnetically draws our attention so that every time there's a pause, every time there's a break, every time you lay your head on your pillow, every time you stop working on a project, your mind immediately gravitates back and you are obsessed with it. And Jesus is saying, look, stop staring at the obstacle. Stop staring at the problem and look up at me. The second thing that we tend to do, he says, don't stare at yourself. Don't stare at yourself. Take your eyes off yourself, not on myself. But because here's the deal. When things go wrong, when we're in a need for a major miracle, we tend to do one of two things. Half of you in this room are what I always refer to as Velcro guilters. If there's any guilt out here in the atmosphere, you suck it in like a vacuum and you Velcro it to yourself. If there's something, it's your fault, right? And so what happens in this moment, about half of you in this room are immediately going, I blew this thing. It's all my fault. What did I do wrong? Why wasn't I a better dad? Why wasn't I a better mom? Why didn't I pay more attention? And all of it's all your fault. I was at the leadership summit this week, and a gal named Sheryl Sandberg, who I forget what her title is, but she's up at the top of the list at Facebook. And 2 years ago, she was in Mexico for a friend's 50th birthday, and her husband keeled over and died. He had a cardiac arrhythmia of some sort, and he died. He'd been off doing something, and they didn't know where he was. They eventually found him. He'd been dead for a while. It was almost instantaneous, and he was gone. And as I'm listening to Cheryl on Thursday, what she said was this. It was fascinating that she went through a period where she said, this was my fault. I should have known about his heart. I should have gone to med school like all my siblings, like a good Jewish girl would do, and known what to do about it. And she went through a season of beating herself up. And men and women, there are some of you, when something goes wrong and you need a miracle, your knee-jerk move is to go, I blew it. It's my fault. I did this. I should have done that. I didn't know enough of that. Whatever. And then the other half of you in this room shift into a totally different gear, and you go, I got to fix this. And you're the can-do, make-it-happen, get-up-with-it, and get-after-it kind of guy or gal, and you're suddenly trying to put together lists and study, and I'm going to go search the internet, and I'm going to figure out how to solve this problem. And you, instead of taking all the blame, you put on all the responsibility saying, I can overcome. But the truth is, all you're really doing is staring in the mirror into your soul saying, it's me. It's all about me. Jesus says, look up. Get your eyes off yourself. Don't look at the obstacle. Don't look at yourself. And then finally, don't look at the results. because we've become so future-oriented. All we can do is see what we want to see happen. It's got to happen. It's got to move. And we're obsessed on that as opposed to being in the moment and finding any level of trust in the Lord. So he says, look up. Don't look at these other things. The second thing I see in here is this. It's just simply, I have to let my desperation drive me to the feet of Jesus. I have to let my desperation. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and he begged. And I love this picture. I mean, there's nothing dignified about Jairus' behavior. There's nothing, that a sense of having it together. It is raw desperation. He no longer cares about the crowd. He doesn't care about his peers. He doesn't care about anybody around him. He doesn't care what people think about him. He has reached this point where he is so done worrying about everybody else. All he can do is throw himself at the feet. And it's a mega crowd. There's a mess of folks watching him. And it shows up. And you can just hear the desperation, the agony in his voice. Please come touch my daughter. And that desperation drives him not to go fix it, not to go obsess, but to the feet of Jesus in total helplessness to say, I can't, would you? And it's not this kind of polite, churchy prayer. Earlier this week, a couple of days ago, I forget, one of the days, Wednesday, Thursday morning, I got up like you usually do. I was having my time with the Lord, having a quiet time, having this 15, 20, 30 minutes of reading the Word and having some time of prayer. And so I got up like I usually do, and I'm in there, and I'm getting nowhere. I'm trying to read the Word, and it's like it's all in Greek, actually it was in Greek, but I was reading English, but it was written. Anyway, that's an attempt at a joke, so I had to throw the extra piece in. It didn't work very well, but I'm getting nowhere. I mean, it's like I keep trying to read it, and it's like I'm getting nothing. It's like dead to me. So then I'm trying to pray, and I can't get anywhere past, our Father. I just can't. It's just not happening. And so I kind of quit doing that. I tried to do something else, and I tried to do this. Nothing's really jiving, and I'm kind of feeling numb. And so I end up getting up, walking around the house, and I end up finding myself up in the room where my treadmill is, and there's not a lot up in there. So I had this passage kind of on my mind, so I just laid down on the floor on my face and started kind of praying, and the next thing I knew, I was sobbing about some stuff that felt like I needed a miracle in. And I'm just kind of crying about this thing, and I'm laying down before the Lord, and actually now stuff's really kind of, and in the back of my mind, I have this thought, okay, seriously, men and women, I'm a sick guy. I'm laying on the floor, and in my thought, I have this thought of, I sure hope Susan doesn't come in and see me like this. What is that? Well, we know what that is. It's pride. It's my dignity. You have to come to a place where your desperation supersedes your dignity. And you're willing to humiliate yourself at the feet of Jesus because it's the only hope you've got. And as long as you're worried more about what others think, then you'll really just never get to that place you need to get. And let me give you this last, because what Jesus says is, don't be afraid. Trust me. Don't be afraid. Trust me. I mean, don't let this fear consume you. Don't let anxiety, worry, all this obsession, all of this projecting what it's going to look like. Don't go there. Just trust me. So what does that mean? What I see in Jairus is three things. Is one, is trust Jesus even when it's too late. Isn't this astounding? These guys show up. The servants from the house, all these friends of Jairus's, all show up. They all come to Jesus. They all come to Jairus and say, she is dead. D-E-A-D, dead. She is gone. She is history. She's dead. We know. We checked. There was no pulse. There was no breathing. She is dead. And what are they really saying? What they're saying is, it is too late. It's over. So stop bothering Jesus. And you might think Jesus will go, well, if it's over, it's over. Well, see y'all. But he says, trust me. I just wonder how many things in your life right now are too late. I'm too old. I'll never get married. I'll never have kids. My career is too far gone, we're too far in debt. We'll never get out of this deal, or the marriage or the relationship is so broken, it will never get fixed. It's too far. I've made too many mistakes. I am doomed. Because we get this mentality, it is too late. And what Jesus is saying to Jairus is it is never too late. The greatest illustration of this, men and women, is the resurrection of Christ. He dies on the cross. He is dead. Everybody is sure of it. They bury him in a tomb for 3 days. Everybody has given up hope. It is over. And then he resurrects and comes out of the grave. And the God who can resurrect can do anything. And it is never too late. And there are times when you will cling to Jesus saying, Jesus, I don't see how, but I'm going to cling. What is it in your life that is dead or dying and looks too far gone? Don't give up. The second thing I see in terms of don't be afraid, just trust Jesus, is trust Jesus even when you're the only one. Even if you are the only one. The servants all show up, she is dead. They go home, the mourners all look around going, you are idiots, she is dead. You have no sense that the disciples were all going, hey, we're with you on this thing, Jesus. You get the feeling they're kind of going, she's dead. But Jesus turns to Jairus and says, I don't care if anybody else out here is going to trust me. I don't care if they're laughing at you because you're going to trust me. You keep trusting. And even when it looks foolish, even when it looks crazy, even when you're the only one who holds out hope that something can change, you stay the course. Never give up on that. And then finally, it says this whole thought of Jesus, you got to trust Jesus to take you where you can't take yourself. I want you to notice a subtle little change that happens in this passage. Look back at verse 24. And in verse 24, there's this powerful little moment when he shows up and he goes, oh, please, 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 will you touch me? Will you touch my daughter? Will you come? And look at the first words of verse 24. So Jesus went with him. What is that telling us? Jairus is in control. Jairus has got a hold of his sleeve, his arm, his whatever, and he's, you're coming with me, Jesus. And he is the guy, he's leading Jesus. He's getting Jesus where he wants Jesus to go. But then there's this word that she dies. And look down, if you would, at verse 40. It says, but they laughed at him. And after Jesus put them all out, Jesus took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him, and he led them in where the child was. It's totally flip-flopped. Jairus has nothing left. He is so empty, so broken, so done. He has given up all hope. And in that moment, Jesus takes Jairus to a place that Jairus could never go by himself. Jesus will let you, he will let you spend yourself trying to save the day. He will let you drag him along, but there will come a point where you can't take that next step. And when you're finally there, Jesus will come along and take you and carry you forward. It's one of the most tender things in this entire passage is that he tenderly takes the heartbroken mom, the heartbroken dad, 3 skeptical disciples, and he brings them to the bed of the dead girl. And then she rises. When the dream is dead, when the hope is gone, Jesus has not left. And it's in that moment that he does something miraculous. Isn't it astounding how many times Jesus lets people die in the scriptures? He lets this little girl die. He could have said something. He could have said, oh, Jairus, I got this. Be healed, done. All right, we'll see you later. He did it other places. He didn't. Mary and Martha write to Jesus saying, Jesus, your good friend Lazarus is sick. He's going to die. And Jesus sits there for 4 days and lets him die and then moves. There are times that Jesus will let the hope, the dream, die because he wants to take you somewhere else on the other side of that thing. It's not that he doesn't love you. It's not mad at you. He's not punishing you. But that's the only way to get you where you need to go, to get you and make you into who you need to be. And so when the hope is dead, you got to trust Jesus that he's not done and he's going to take you somewhere else. In a room this size, there's a mess of miracles that we need. Kind of felt the prompting earlier in the week. We're going to follow up on this morning. And some of you need to fall at the feet of Jesus in one way or another. And we don't have some fancy altar. What we got is a little wall. Jesus isn't physically up here, but there's always that sense that we need to do something. We need to let our desperation drive us to the feet of Jesus. So I'm just going to invite you for the next few minutes. If you'd like to just come up here, kneel at the wall for a minute, just bring your obstacle, your need, your heartbreak, your impossibility before the Lord. I'm just going to give you that moment. And there's no pressure. It's not like it's a performance. But also, I'm going to beg you, don't let your dignity keep you from falling in the feet of Jesus and asking him for what you need. So we're going to create a space for a few minutes. Come if you want, no pressure. Band is going to play a little bit and just have a little instrumental. So you just do what you need to do, but if you'd like to come bring something to Jesus, you come on up and do that. Would you just come up and be up here maybe in the wings in case somebody were to need you? So any of our prayer team members come up and do that for us, that'd be great. Don't have to kneel if it's uncomfortable. You guys stay up here as long as you want, or if you're out here and you want to come on up, come and do that. Joel, we're going to sing this song called I Need You, and so just lead us softly over that. If you're out here and you want to sing along softly, please do that, but let's just allow Jesus to work as we go. Thank you. band to just keep playing for a little while. You're welcome to stay up front. You're welcome to come up front. You're welcome to sit where you are. But they're going to play for a little bit, so just stay with the Lord as you want. If you're ready to go and you need to get kids or whatever it may be, then you go ahead and make that move. We'll be here if we can serve you in any way. And I just want to assure you that as you fall at the feet of Jesus, He can work. He cares for what you need. And He will come to you and with you as you walk. God bless you guys. Look forward to seeing you next weekend.